You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, algorithms are at play in so many of our decisions, from what we watch on a streaming service to the news stories we search for on the internet or the products we want to buy online, to even what a brick and mortar store carries in inventory. But the authors of the bestseller Big Data, who pointed out how AI and algorithms have changed economics, science, and culture, are back with a new book that they refer to as the uniquely human advantage in a world filled with technology. The act of framing, the ability to make a mental model that lets us see patterns, predict how events will unfold, and make sense of new situations. Frames lets us see the world by magnifying certain elements and minimizing others. Humans can do it, but machines apparently are lousy at it. Frames helped Apple beat Nokia by framing a phone as a computer, and let Spotify outdistance Apple by framing music as an experience. Frames can be diametrically opposed. A public health frame says we should all wear masks during a pandemic. A personal liberty frame says each should make their own decisions. Context is key. Well, my guest today will help make a sense of that context. He's one of a trio of writers behind the book Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. It's published by Dutton. Victor Meyer Schoenberger is a co-author of Big Data and is a professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the University of Oxford Internet Institute. He, along with Kenneth Couquier of The Economist and Francis de Vericourt of the European School of Management and Technology, are the co-authors of Framers. Victor Meyer Schoenberger, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us. And welcome virtually back to Oklahoma, where you began your career.
Thank you, Rich. It's wonderful to be back.
We've heard about framing for a number of years in terms of personal relationships and understanding how other people think. But we create frames that guide our decision-making, our opinions, virtually every day. And as technology grows, it's a skill that humans can do really well at times that machines really depend on humans for. Why is this important?
It's important, Rich, because as we are looking at what humans still do, a lot of people focus on our ability to make decisions. And they narrow their focus on our ability to pick among two options and to do that well. But in our book, we argue that that actually is far too narrow a view and that underplays our human ability to think, because our human ability to think and to prepare for decisions is all not just about picking among two options, but to come up with a rich set of options in the first place. It doesn't help you if you have two bad options and you need to pick among them. It's far better if you have three really good options, and then it doesn't matter that much which one of them you pick. That's the power of framing.
And of course, as we use more technology, we create the frames that help technology implement our decisions, guide our decisions. That framing is very important.
And we see it everywhere, whether it's, you know, self-driving cars. It's amazing what they can do, but they can only achieve that because we imposed upon them our mental frames, our mental models. We humans, we think in mental models. We can't think without them. We are framers by nature. And rather than just taking that as a fact, we should actually take that as an opportunity to hone that cognitive muscle and to use it better and more often.
How well do we actually use that cognitive muscle? And how well do we hone it?
Not well enough. What is interesting is that when we look at great innovators, you know, Steve Jobs or Elon Musk, when we look at athletes or when we look at artists, we see amazing people who kind of came up with alternative views or perspectives. And we are in awe about that. But the truth is that they're just good framers, and being a good framer is something we can do as well. It's, in fact, something that we start training and practicing as toddlers, but we forget much of it later in life, unfortunately.
And, of course, in this day and age, with technology so ubiquitous, I think we do you think we overtly rely on technology to help guide our decisions instead of using technology to guide our decisions?
I think you're on to something, Rich. You know, over the last 30 years or so, 40 years perhaps, research has shown how bad humans are in picking among two or three options. Often we are biased. We have cognitive distortion and pick the wrong things. We want to avoid losses, or we think the wrong way about the options we face. And so people have concluded that if humans are bad in making this decision, maybe we should let machines make the decisions for us. But that's the wrong way. You know, even if humans are bad in picking two options, we are good, if we want to, at coming up with good options. And then picking which option of the three good ones we pick isn't that important anymore. We shouldn't rely on machines. We should rely on humans.
Well, let's take a step back. What do we mean by frames when it comes to decision making? And what are some examples that you mean by frames?
A frame is a mental model, basically the way we see the world. So to the capitalist, the world is all about money and is about transactions. When a capitalist looks at a forest, he sees money to be made. When an environmentalist looks at the forest, he sees trees to be preserved. That's a kind of mental model that we bring to situations and that change or shape our decision-making, whether it's in the corporate world, whether it's in business, or whether it's in our individual daily lives.
You begin the book with how one scientist, Regina Barzilay, used technology in her particular frame to approach a problem of finding a new bacteria-killing drug, and one that bacteria hasn't developed resistance to. How did she use her particular frame to do that? Tell us her story.
Well, Regina Barzilay is, as a computer scientist at MIT, focused on artificial intelligence and machine learning. So what she did was to take a huge database of lots of different chemical agents, basically medicines that have been identified and used before, and asked her AI to see whether any of the chemical agents could have antibacterial activity effect. And fortunately, she found one. Now, the newspapers reporting on it said, wow, you know, AI found the new antibiotic. But what actually happened was far more human, and that is Barzilay said, look, in the past, we always have looked for antibiotics that are chemically similar to the antibiotics we already know. And so we tried the similarity route. How about if we discard the similarity route and look for anything that has the same effect, irrespective of how it is chemically constructed? That was a switch in frame. That was a shift in her framing that she did. And then asking the computer to just sort of look through the database is the necessary next step. But it wasn't the computer who came up with that framing shift. It was Barzilay, and that made the discovery possible.
Now, was that completely counterintuitive to what other scientists were doing? And because, you know, everyone was looking for a new drug that would combat antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Sure, but most large drug companies, maybe because they're risk-averse, maybe because they're just like following the conventional path, you know, being path-dependent, they were looking at compounds, chemical compounds, that were very similar in structure to what was already known to be antibiotics. And Barzilay said, let's not look at the structure, let's look at the effect. And that was, in a way, that switch, that mental switch, that enabled her to see more options. And what she did basically was to ask what-if questions. What if we're not looking at structure? What if we're looking at effect? That's the power of it.
My guest today is Victor Meyer Schoenberger. He's a co-author of the big bestseller, Big Data, and his latest book with two other co-authors is titled Frames, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. It's published by Dutton. He's a professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford in the UK, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the most important skills in developing frames is seeing causal relationships, causality. And you use the example of Ben Bernanke, who was then head of the Federal Reserve back in 2008, who drew on a causal frame to react to the financial meltdown. He looked to the lessons of the Great Depression, which was less about the stock market crash, but the reaction to the stock market crash, where the country basically constricted capital. How did a causal frame determine his actions?
Well, Bernanke, in his earlier career, had studied the 1920s and the 1930s, and he had understood that there was a causal link between the unavailability of capital, the capital crunch, after the stock market crash in the 1920s and 30s, and the depression on Main Street that then followed. And he was worried that when money supply dries up for small businesses on Main Street, the effect on the economy will be far larger than a stock market crash. And with that knowledge, he was he happened to be at the right place at the right time, because when we faced a financial crisis about a little over 10 years ago, he realized the problem wasn't the stock market crash. The potential was that it might crash Main Street, not just Wall Street, because credit might dry up. And that's when he decided to add more money, add money supply, and he got the nickname Helicopter Ben for throwing money off the helicopter to businesses.
And of course, that did work. What's interesting is today with the pandemic, policymakers are also relying on a causal frame based on 2008 and 2009, which, you know, the Federal Reserve did loosen the money. And in fact, it has stayed loose for probably the last 12 years. But what happened in Congress was they cut down on the amount of money of stimulus. And the thinking is that it prolonged the pain from the meltdown for a number of years. And so this time around, they're swinging big. They've been swinging big since the first start of the pandemic, and you know the Biden administration is still doing it. Will that causal relationship work the same? That is a big open question, isn't it?
It absolutely is. But what is important here is to understand that we can debate and discuss these causal relationships, and it's important that we do that. But in order to do that, we need to actually see them in the first place. And we need to see the various causal dynamics. That's the advantage that we humans have. We see the world as a sequence of causes and effects. Sometimes we are deadly wrong, but a lot of times we are right. In fact, we are so often right that we don't realize it. We go through the daily lives that we live, and more often than not, our causal understanding is right. These causal templates that we are developing really help us focus on what's necessary, on the decisions that are necessary to take. Doesn't prevent us, though, from making wrong decisions at times.
Yeah, and sometimes making that causal relationship is correct. Sometimes it's incorrect. In fact, frames can be created and acted on with disastrous consequences. In your introduction, you talk about something that happened in the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And it was referred to as Lysenkoism. And Lysenko was a communist theorist who had responsibility for agriculture. What was Lysenkoism?
It was the idea that you should drastically push for monocultures because there is only one class in a classless society. And as they pushed for it, the total output on crops in the Soviet Union dropped dramatically, and famines followed, killing millions and millions of people. It was a really, really bad framing example. Now, the point here, of course, is that the frame isn't necessarily bad. Sometimes monocultures are good. But there is a lot of bad framing. That is, you pick a frame for the wrong context or for the wrong goal. And that's what Lysenko did. And so the magic, if you want, Rich, is to pick the right frame for the right situation and then work it and then play with it. Because the frame is, the mental model is your helper, your supporter, it's your guide.
Oh. The next step after you use these causal relationships to help develop your frame is something you call counterfactual thinking. And it's imagining alternative paths or actions. And you use the example of JFK. When he first became president, he was presented with a plan for the Bay of Pigs. And he was surrounded by people who said, this is what to do. You know, we need to invade Cuba. Well, of course, we know how that ended. 2 years later, he's facing a missile crisis. He, instead of surrounding himself with people who had one outcome and one course of action, he put together a group that developed sort of several different courses of action, and they eventually settled on two. How important is this in developing frames?
It's absolutely crucial. As we see with the example at JFK, the problem wasn't the actual decision-making. The problem was that the option that JFK had on the table were just conventional and not good enough. They would perhaps or probably lead to global nuclear war. We need to do better than that, he said. And so they tried to come up with other options. And one option was a quarantine around Cuba, and then an option for the Soviets to pull back, and at the same time, to save face, the U.S. would also take back some nuclear-tipped rockets from Turkey, which, by the way, weren't that effective in the first place, so it wasn't a big loss. But it was a face-saving device for the situation, and that was a far better option. That was a package that both sides could agree on and avoid nuclear war. What is crucial, therefore, is not just to pick among two options that are both bad, but to come up with better options. And for that, you need a lot of people from different perspectives around the table to propose good ideas.
The counterfactual thinking is sort of imagining a variety of approaches, isn't it, though? Just beyond just two approaches in this particular example, it's about really trying to imagine something that may not particularly exist at this particular point in time, correct?
Yes. That was the thing that happened with around the table, JFK. You know, at first they were just thinking about military action rather than a sort of diplomatic solution, perhaps because the people that he first asked were all from the military, and that was what they immediately thought about. And counterfactual thinking is something that we do all the time. It is what-if thinking. You know, we imagine, what if we do this? What would then happen? How would that change the trajectory of the world? What-if thinking helps us see what isn't there yet, but what could be there if we wanted to. Therefore, what it does in the end is it broadens our option space. It gives us more options than we normally perceive.
My guest today is Victor Meyer Schoenberger. He's the co-author of the new book, Frames, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. He's also co-author of the bestseller, Big Data. He's a professor of internet governance and regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute. And Frames looks at creating these frameworks for helping us do innovation, empowerment, and to make good decisions. And we talked about finding causal links, counterfactual thinking, and the next is constraints. What do we mean by constraints?
That is the magic of framing, of good framing. It's constraints. It's reducing the possibilities, the counterfactuals, if you want, the alternative worlds that we think of, to the ones that are most actionable. And, you know, there is this saying that we should think outside the box. Now, that is a terrible cliche, not only because we are always in a box, that is, we're always inside a mental model, but more importantly, it is bad because it seems to imply that the box is wrong and we should get rid of it. In fact, the box, that is the mental model, is really what we need to guide us in our counterfactual thinking, because it comes with constraints. You know, when Frank Gehry, the famous architect, was asked how he comes up with the designs, he says, "I am constrained in my designs, for example, by gravity. 85% of it is constraints. But then I have 15% of freedom," and that's the kind of counterfactual thinking, the what if, the new creations that really make a difference. When we think of SpaceX and Elon Musk's rockets, those rockets landing back at the landing strip upright, this isn't giving up on the laws of physics. It's all because of the laws of physics that it works. So the frame that SpaceX and Elon Musk have is tightly constrained by the laws of physics, by engineering, by computer power. And that is true for almost any innovator out there. They are not thinking crazily. They're thinking and dreaming and imagining with constraints.
Of course, the idea of thinking outside the box is not putting artificial restraints, you know, real restraints and real constraints. That's something we have, that's real, you know, that's reality. But oftentimes we will put artificial restraints in place by thinking of, you know, when we think of the nine dot exercise, which is what out of the box came from. It's like we created that restraint out of our own lack of imagination. So you're not talking about that, right?
No, I'm talking about the need to, when we think about constraints, to also think about which of those constraints are hard and cannot be altered, and which of them can be altered, which are soft. And when we think about how to change a constraint in order to come up with a better what-if, with a better alternative, then we have some heuristics in the book, like we should pick a constraint or change a constraint that is easily changeable but creates minimal change, doesn't create huge change. That way we can kind of iterate through possible options. That's what good innovators do. Thinking about constraints means understanding constraints.
One of the other, once you have a frame, sometimes frames will be in conflict with one another, and picking the right frame is really important. Can you maybe discuss a little bit about that?
Sure. At the level of the constraints, you know, it's very important that one constraint isn't inconsistent with another constraint. Otherwise, your thinking breaks down. So, for example, if you are very religious and Christian, then the pure Darwinistic frame of evolution isn't going to help you, because it's inconsistent with some of your other beliefs. And so that will not in itself provide better options for you that are still consistent with the values that you have. Consistency is a really important element. But then sometimes the context changes so dramatically, the reality changes so fundamentally, that we need to leave behind the frame that we have and switch to an entirely different frame. That doesn't happen very rarely, and that doesn't mean that the old frame is totally wrong. It just means that the new frame oftentimes is better. Can I give an example?
Yes.
You know, think about the world being round versus the world being flat. Now, you know, when we realize that the world is round, it actually helped us understand a lot of things far more easily, like sun rises in the morning and the moon and all of that. But for all practical purposes, if we measure a piece of land in our backyard, we can assume that the world is flat, and measure it like a flat piece of land, even though there is a slight curvature thanks to the curvature of the earth. But we don't need that, because in this particular context, just measuring our backyard, it doesn't make much difference. That's what we mean when we say you need to pick the right frame. There aren't that many bad frames, but there's a lot of bad framing.
Yes. Well, I was going to use the example of COVID-19, for example. You know, certain countries really framed COVID-19 as a new outbreak of flu, or of perhaps an even slightly more dangerous flu, but like that. Others looked at it like it was SARS, right?
Yes, yes. And in fact, you have two islands that did that, both English-speaking. New Zealand, on the one hand, looking at COVID like SARS, like a real dangerous disease, infectious disease. And Great Britain is looking at it like a flu that you have to mitigate, but basically suffer through it. Now, of course, in New Zealand, after a very harsh lockdown of a couple of weeks, they could reopen and live a perfectly normal life most of last year, while in the UK, there were literally tens of thousands of people dying. And that was not because there was different viruses with the same virus. The data was the same, but the politicians and decision makers in Britain framed the problem differently from those in New Zealand.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you, one great thing about this book is it's filled with examples from business, from government, from innovation that sort of lays out the theory of framing. How do you envision framing working in a 21st century work situation? You know, a lot of people are worried about technology displacing jobs, and there are a lot of jobs that theoretically could be on the line. How can framing mitigate that or give us a new framework for working jobs that exist now that could be at risk for technology displacement?
You know, jobs that are at risk potentially in the near future are those that depend on simple decisions. I have two options. I need to make a quick decision. Machines can oftentimes do that and do that fairly well. But we humans can do something better. We can come up with the right options to start with. And so what we need to think about, I think, is what in each and every job we can do in order to come up with better options, because that is why we humans are still needed in that place and still need it in society, because we can dream better options. We can dream up what the machine can never think about, can never come up with. That means we also need to rethink the workplace, if you want. The workplace isn't necessarily just a physical place where we congregate, but where we interact with each other. So good companies, organizations that have understood the power of framing also want to make sure that their employees interact with each other in order to pressure each other to come up with better frames.
The name of the book is Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. Victor Meyer Schoenberger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
Victor Meyer Schoenberger is a professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University in the UK. He's the co-author of Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil, along with Kenneth Cukier of The Economist magazine and Francis de Vericourt of the European School of Management and Technology. The book is published by Dutton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.